go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Clear on my Mac on iTunes, Bob reports Randy in our Pennsylvania listening station. 2 minutes past the hour, another brilliant 2 hours with Dr. Bill O'Brien. Again, I encourage you to, if you can't listen live, to take the podcast for Dr. Bill. You will be more historically literate about the origins and institutions of this country than by listening to any other broadcaster, period. It's that simple. Dr. Bill O'Brien is, of course, on from Monday to Wednesday of any given week from 4 to 6 p.m. with occasional forays into 3 to 5 based on his scheduling needs. Thank you, Dr. Bill. Thank you. So here it is, Wednesday, middle of the week, second day on the air after returning from my whirlwind but magnificent trip to northern Wisconsin. I hope you all got a chance to hear Jeff Biggers on the program last night. I think he had information that was very, very important for all of us. And a note from Duncan, our chat room moderator and moderator of the host of the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. That's the gang that gets together and chats after Malloy's over at 12:05, 5 past midnight Eastern time, that is. And Duncan received a pitch from the Sierra Club, all about ending mountaintop removal. Curiously, that pitch from the Sierra Club, talking about ending mountaintop removal, had absolutely no mention whatsoever of the only, and let me repeat, only bill in Congress with the power to end mountaintop removal. Doesn't that seem a bit strange? Thanks, Jeremy. Vermont Reporting Station, loud and clear on TuneIn. Thank you very much. But really, here's the Sierra Club saying that they want to end mountaintop removal. And let me pull it up here real quick so I can get to it. Texas Reporting Station in. Thank you, Betsy. Loud and clear in Texas. Ain't the intertubes grand? The EPA just failed us. Bruce Niles, Senior Director of Beyond Coal Campaign of the Sierra Club, says, instead of protecting our health and water, they gave... Hey, look, no mention of the air. Oh, damn. I guess we still got some uphill learning curve work to do with the Sierra Club. Instead of protecting our health and water, they gave polluters another free pass to destroy Appalachian streams and rivers with mountaintop removal mining pollution. Never mind the ultra-fine particulate dust that's so small that it can pass through the pores of individual cell membranes and wreak all manner of havoc. Who cares? I mean, the EPA doesn't. They don't even have a standard for dealing with ultra-fine particulates, right? Bruce Niles, right? Despite hearing from over 41,000 people, the EPA bowed to pressure from the coal industry and allowed Kentucky to relax protections on toxic selenium pollution from mountaintop removal mines. Selenium pollution, which causes significant biological damage to fish. leaches into our rivers and streams from the blown-off mountaintop rock and dirt. Really? Really? The fish get higher billing from the Sierra Club than the human beings do. Isn't that just lovely?
Lovely.
Shame on the EPA for putting the interests of big coal before that of Appalachian fish. No, communities, waterways, and wildlife. The EPA has allowed Kentucky to change. Yada, yada, yada. Thanks for all you do. Send a petition to the EPA. And then there's the one that Duncan saw, which talks about, let's see here. Yeah, there it is. Raise your voice. End mountaintop removal coal mining. Mountaintop removal coal mining blows off the tops of mountains to extract the coal that fuels our nation's power plants. Oh, for F's sake. Really, guys? I mean, somebody at the Sierra Club is seriously mailing it in. What about the export market, Sierra Club? Oh, wait, you don't want to mention the export market, because that's got lots of, every year, more stuff leaves Appalachia on a boat. Well, I mean, first a truck, then a train, then a boat, and goes to foreign countries. European countries, even. Places like Denmark. Germany, no less. Mountaintop removal coal mining blows off the tops of mountains to extract the coal that fuels our nation's power plants. It and steel mills in India and steel mills in Russia and steel mills in China and power plants in China and power plants in Russia and power plants in India and power plants in Denmark and power plants in... You get the idea. It has already leveled 500 mountains and buried over 1,200 miles of streams, but it gets worse. It raises the risk of... Oh, look! Humans! Instead of fish! It raises the risk of birth defects, cancer, and heart disease for local communities. They noticed! Well, bust my buttons! Right now, wait a minute, next paragraph, right now dozens of permits are pending for new mines and the Obama administration could approve them any day. If they get approved, it will mean more people get sick and more mountains get destroyed. What about the fish? Take 30 seconds right now and tell the White House to put our communities and their health first. End mountaintop removal coal mining. Personalize the message text on the right with your own words if you wish. And that's the whole thing. This link has been put on the Horn Facebook page. So run on over that away. But here, let me cut to the chase. There's not a blessed mention of the only bill in the Congress of the United States that would end mountaintop removal. They are as silent as the tomb about H.R. 526, the AIC Act. Maybe it's because they don't control it. Maybe it's because they're not so very particularly happy with the hillbillies out there doing stuff on their own. You know, we waited around for the Sierra Club to get their thumbs out of their asses, both of them, for in excess of a decade. And they just kept marching and sending petitions and fooling around in the administrative system and hosting demonstrations and bullshit. And that's how the AIC Act got born. We got tired of waiting around for the people that told us they were ever so much smarter than us to do something about it. While our friends, our neighbors, our loved ones, our fellow Appalachians got sick and died. Excess deaths, the statisticians call them. We know them as grandma. Or a baby nephew, or a wife, or a husband, or a sister, or a brother, or a cousin, or an aunt, or an uncle, mother, or father. But here's the upshot. You can do what Duncan did. Duncan responded to that petition with the following. It's time to end mountaintop removal coal mining. Pass the AIC Act now, H.R. 526, the only bill in Congress that will end mountaintop removal. You know, maybe if they start seeing a few of these things, they might actually figure out a way to pay attention. What? Oh my God, Biffy. Look, the hillbillies are trying to do something. Don't they realize we fundraise a positive shitload of money on their hillbilly backs? Yeah. Couldn't even be bothered to, and you know, just so we're clear, you know why they didn't mention the export market? Because the Sierra Club has $50 million from Michael Bloomberg. All for the purpose of shutting down coal-fired power plants in the United States. And they could shut down every coal-fired power plant in the United States, and our mountains and our communities would still go boom to the tune of about 5.5 million pounds of high explosives per day. And our friends, our friends, our neighbors, our wives, cousins, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, nephews, nieces, neighbors, colleagues, co-workers, would still be finding themselves periodically sitting in a doctor's office with a doctor with a grim look on her face saying, well, you know, you got cancer. But I thought the Sierra Club stopped all the coal-fired power plants. Well, they did, sunshine. But there's still tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of coal getting on trucks and trains and boats and leaving Appalachia. Because, you know, really, you hillbillies just aren't that important. So maybe pass the word around. Go to the Head On Radio Network, go to the Horn Facebook page, and follow the link, and go tell them. Tell them it's time to get serious about the AIC Act. Tell them that the Obama administration's EPA administrative rules can be changed with the next president. We need a law that forbids this from happening, and the only one out there is the AIC Act. So take action if you care to. And then, having take action, and this is kind of a big deal, share it. Share it around. Send it around. Explain that the Sierra Club has, and the Natural Resources Defense Council and others, have left Appalachia flapping in the breeze. The coal dust-laden breeze. The ultra-fine particulate dust-laden breeze. It sure would be nice. I don't tell anybody to do anything. But if you would be willing to go and do something like this, it would be really, really helpful. Okay? Thanks. This is not, of course, to say that I don't know what today is. Today is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Tim, you're getting way too highfalutin there in the chat room. Today is Bible Study Wednesday? No, Tim, this is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. You got to get in the hillbilly spirit of things. And I am proud to announce this Prayer Meeting Wednesday that I had a note from our good friend Robert up over in Australia. Once again, it's time for the 20th of the month Up Over Down Under Challenge. I'll match the first $50 donated today with $50 of my own. And, of course, it would be nice if someone or someone's matched that with another 50. And greetings to one and all from the land of Oz. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Hopefully that'll get us going in a nice way. Because we're in a deep, 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 like horn going off the air kind of hole. It is in excess of, near $500. So if folks will match Robert's offer, that'll bring us down to near 400. And it, well, it's badly needed. Because, you know, once again, I remind you, we don't run any ads here. We don't direct. We don't try to direct you to. We're not delivering you to potential commercial relationships. But yes, yes, indeed, I do know what today is. It's ever so much more than Wednesday or hump day. More than the middle of the week, more than downhill to Friday. It is, in fact, prayer meeting Wednesday on the Horn, as noted. And it's time, we had our fellowship dinner, and the deacons are all filled up with pineapple upside down cake this evening. You'd be surprised. They will actually fight one another, those deacons will, for the slices with the little red cherry in the middle of the pineapple ring. I never understand why, but they come near to fisticuffs. But we chased them in out of the parking lot where they were having their post-prandial cigarette out there with the sinners, ran them through the vestibule, down past the bowl of 20-year-old desiccated butter mints, and all the way down into the front row, where when they start to snoozing, I can get them with the flip gun. Thank you, Asa. Thank you very, very much. Asa has responded to Robert's challenge, and if you would like to respond to Asa, that will get us well on the way to getting us at least up to eye level above the hole. So thank you very much, Asa. So now, with everybody in the pews, and with the deacons getting ready for their nap, and thank you, Betsy. Betsy has taken up the challenge and met half of what Asa sent. Thank you very kindly. So another $25, and we will have met Asa, and we'll build it that way. Thank you very much. But now, with the deacons ready for their late autumnal snooze, we will bring the Minister of Music forward for the offertory hymn. Brother Minister of Music, if you would, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, maresy dotes and nosy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddly divey too. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? I love you. Welcome, brethren and sistren.
Come on down that blood-red aisle and fall on your knees at the altar and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through you from the server on. I am Archpope Uber Rabbi, ultimate imam, antagonized agnostic, animated animist, Bob Kincaid. And this here is the Cathedral of Common Sense Prayer Meeting Wednesday edition. Glory, hallelujah. We've got, brethren and sistren, we've got two stories of faithful, grace-filled, Bible-believing Christianity for you this evening. Yes, we do. Hallelujah. We go down to Alabama, stand, brethren and sistren, where David Ferguson of the Raw Story reached out to a Bible-believing Christian by the name of Duane Bridges. That's Duane, not D-Wayne. That's Duane. Say it right, just like he said, do, Lord, oh, do remember me. Up away beyond Galilee. Hallelujah. Amen. Praise his holy name. Duane Bridges is a representing in the Alabama legislature. And Duane Bridges has got him a law he wants to pass for the people of Alabamistan. He's trying to amend the Alabama State Constitution, which was passed in like 1905 or some such, and is about a million pages long from previous amendments. And that constitutional amendment would allow public schools and other state properties, maybe the county landfill, for instance, to display the Ten Commandments. And the folks over there to the Raw Story, they called Duane Bridges, not D-Wayne, damn it. He's liable to get irksome if you call him D-Wayne or Dwayne. He's Duane Bridges. And Duane Bridges wants to amend the Alabama Stand Constitution so that they can put the Ten Commandments up all over the place if the state of Alabama happens to open it, own it. So when the Raw Story reached out to representing Duane Bridges to ask if a similar effort would be made to display Judaic and Islamic documents, well, he got all head up and hung up the demon telephone. Praise. Representing Duane Bridges done said on the telephone about his HB 45, well, that's not the way I feel, meaning he didn't feel like it would be a stupid thing to sit there and waste millions and millions of taxpayer dollars in conservative family values Alabama stand to defend a law that is patently unconstitutional, or would be if we had sane people, or at least a majority of sane people, on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States. But until then, it's a complete crapshoot. He said, that's not the way I feel, because, you know, how you feel when you're presenting unconstitutional legislation, that's your real litmus test. I've had it checked out, Duane Bridges said, and it won't just be the Ten Commandments, if that's what you're referring to. There'll be historical documents with it, and I don't know if Duane Bridges realizes this, being as how he has an itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny little pinprick of a brain. He probably didn't, but he just admitted that the Ten Commandments ain't historical. There'll be historical documents with it, which is rather reminiscent of the great big right-wing religion industry hissy fit recently being thrown against the heathens over to the Costco. I wish we had a Costco around here. Come on, guys, please. Some of us would like to never, ever, ever, ever enter Sam's Club or Wally World again for as long as we live. Give us somewhere to go. Build it, and they will shop. But a fine, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian went on down to his local Costco because I reckon he needed a new Bible. Maybe he'd wore the ink plum off the other one. But he was a wandering around the Costco and said, "Where's the Bibles?" "Welcome to Costco. I love you." He says, "Where's the Bibles?" And they point him to the book rack. And imagine his horror. This upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, California-living Christian, when he goes back to where Costco keeps all the books, and he picks him up a Bible, and it's got a price tag on it. Well, I mean, they all do. My goodness gracious, the Bible has a price tag on it that we can't even begin to contemplate, doesn't it? But no, it has a price tag on it. And I think the Bible was $14.99. But here's what got the Pastor Caleb Kaltenbach of Simi Valley, California, all hot and bothered and be under his bonnet and burr under his saddle. That sticker on that Bible and all of them Bibles said $14.99 fiction. That's only because they don't have a, I guess that's only because they don't have a bullshit section for, never mind. Yes, indeed. He said, "All the Bibles were labeled as fiction. It seemed bizarre to me." Well, Brother Caleb, I would suggest you read your book because there's all kinds of bizarre in there. Women getting turned into salt and kings of Israel, cavorting and smolicking and lollygagging around with concubines in traditional family marriages and people getting thrown in pits and patriarchs are telling Pharaoh that their wife is their sister. "She's my sister! She's my sister!" Yeah. And pimping her out. And, oh, my goodness gracious. Sun standing still in the sky because, you know, it revolves around the earth. There's all kinds of bizarre crap in there. Somehow or another, charging $14.99 for a book and calling it fiction doesn't even, I mean, it really doesn't, it don't matter. It don't measure up on the bizarre scale once you've opened that book, Brother Caleb Kaltenbach. So he immediately got on the phone to his flock there at the non-denominational Discovery Church because it seemed bizarre to him. He said, "People are pretty shocked and upset. We're supposed to be living in an era of tolerance, but what Costco did doesn't seem too tolerant." "If they don't believe in the Bible," he said, "that's fine. They're going to hell. But at least label it as religion, as some bookstores do, or inspiration." Yeah, that's what I'd like to label it as, inspiration. I mean, there's nothing more inspirational than God telling people to go and commit a genocide. Man, that's some inspiration. Or telling his prophet to go marry a hooker. Yeah. Ah, man. On the one hand, Christians should not yell out we aren't living in Iraq or Iran. But on the other hand, I believe that we do need to stand up for our faith and we need to be vocal about our concerns, you know, because God's not big enough to stand up by himself. He's kind of got to be propped up by all little Bible-believing Christians. Over at Costco, once they got done snickering, they said, a spokesperson from Costco said, this was a result of human error at a warehouse. You know how that translates, right? Hey, Leroy, quit labeling the Bibles as fiction. Little fundy weirdos don't take kindly to it. All right. Can I label it as horror next month, boss? We'll see. And Todd Starnes over to the Radio Rwanda Fox News, he said there's still a boatload of Bibles that's marked fiction at the Simi Valley store.
Robert Jeffress. You remember Robert Jeffress? He's the one who said that Bishop Willard Romney belonged to a cult. Because they're real good at telling, at talking about who doesn't believe the right way, but they don't like it at all if you tell them that their book is a load of baloney. That's kind of rough on baloney, though, isn't it? Robert Jeffress of Dallas, Texas, Stan, said, "Let's hope Costco's explanation is true and not the result of having been caught attempting to marginalize the very foundation of Christian beliefs, the Bible. Christians need to call out organizations like Costco whose actions undermine Christianity." Imagine that, a retail wholesale club has the power to undermine 2,000 years of terror religion. They need to be called out regardless of whether those actions are accidental or intentional. Wait a minute, I didn't see any calling out part in the New Testament there in all them red letters in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, but I did see a whole lot about forgiving. Brother Jeffress, you think maybe you might want to reach out and forgive Costco instead, like your holy man zombie does? Done told you to do? Yeah, don't count on it. The Christians are also largely upset because Costco pays a living wage to its workers, by the way. But I've been taken away from my original intent because we were talking about Duane Bridges. Duane, remember me. Sorry. So they asked Duane about whether there'd be any Islamic text or Judaism text or maybe a little something something from the Rig Veda or the little something or another from the Bhagavad Gita or no, he said, "You're wrong. Our country wasn't founded on the Koran or anything else. It was founded on godly principles, so that's what you need to put in there, thank you." Click. America wasn't founded on the Koran. And, you know, no one would probably be more likely to agree with Duane Bridges than a creep by the name of WMAL's Chris Plant. He shows up over on Radio Rwanda Fox News pretty often. And I'm sorry I didn't get to it yesterday. We were just kind of covered up in stories and whatnot. But fact of the matter is, the right wing is done having themselves a hissy over that one in our White House, a reading of the Gettysburg Address. See that brilliant little filmmaker, Ken Burns, who got his start making a film about the Civil War, which can be argued as both a brilliant piece of and a sort of redefinition of the whole paradigm of documentary filmmaking, or characterized as a wholesale misunderstanding of the entire Civil War as history. It was working on a project to mark the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. So he took a copy of there are multiple versions of the Gettysburg Address, and I can't help wondering if maybe Ken Burns was having a little fun at the president's expense because he knows how these right-wing freaks, these Bible-believing Christians and conservatives and birthers and deathers and truthers and booger-eaters and would respond. Because he took the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address, which was the first version of the Gettysburg Address, and simply asked President Obama to read it in front of a video camera. Here's the rub, and here's why the story shows up on prayer meeting Wednesday. The Nicolay version does not include the two words "under God." Because, see, as much as they don't like to acknowledge it, Abraham Lincoln was not a fundamentalist, Bible-thumping, snake-handling, strychnine-swigging, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking freak. He rather took a, he really did, he took an Enlightenment approach to religion, saying, you know, believe as you will and leave me alone. Occasionally he would make reference to providence in his speeches, and ultimately in the Gettysburg Address he referenced one nation under God. But he didn't say which God, or which particular theocratic or theologic definition of him. Whether he was, Trinity didn't come into it, or all that, all those things that Christians lopped each other's heads off over for the first 400 years of the new religion. Abraham Lincoln was a complex personality. He was iffy on slavery, having notably said that if he could keep the Union together and keep slavery, he would gladly do so. Complex man. You can still, in Washington, D.C., at the little church across from Lafayette Park, you can see his pew. He was rather of a back row type, I do believe. He would wander over from time to time just to see what the gospel sharps were talking about on any given Sunday. But no, the right-wingers have gotten themselves, I mean, they've gotten their maiden forms into an absolute Gordian knot over this one. Because that one in our White House didn't say under God. Don't trust me for this. Oh no. Let's check him out. This is from WMAL. This happened yesterday. And it is precious.
That's kind of peculiar. Gee, it's kind of like the way he changed Obamacare, you know? He looks at the 2,400-page bill and the thousands of pages of accompanying regulations, and when he decides that something doesn't work, he just scratches that out and says, you know, well, we won't enforce that. I'll just suggest to the insurance companies that they violate the law of the land. It's settled law. Now, violate it, because I say so. And here's the Gettysburg Address, as carved into the wall of the Lincoln Memorial on the Mall, our sacred mall in Washington, D.C. The Gettysburg Address, on this, the 150th anniversary, the first black president, with Abraham Lincoln's speech, the first Republican president, and somehow these words just hit the cutting room floor. Under God. And those, only those words. Isn't that fascinating? Let's go to the telephones. What?
Yeah, let's go. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that the director of a film has the right to have the words he wants spoken the way he wants them spoken in the film? Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that what do you call him, Barack Hussein Obama? Didn't that every time he said his name, Barack Hussein Obama? Yeah. Cut. Mr. President, no, we gave you the version that doesn't have under God in it. Could you read it according to the script, please? Barack Obama reads the Gettysburg Address, Nicolay version, take two, and roll them. So that this nation under God. Cut! You did it again, Mr. President. Oh, did I? I'm terribly sorry. President Obama reads the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address, take three. Roll them! Isn't that fascinating? Because, see, there are multiple versions, one that says under God and one that doesn't. I wish Ken Burns had given him the under God version, for heaven's sake, so that people like Chris Plante of WMAL wouldn't have this to fulminate over. Let's go to the phones, he said.
why does it matter? Why do you care? You know, there are those who are going to say, this is not a story. You're just, you know, who cares? What are you making this up for? You know who they are. Let me go to Rob in Fairfax. Rob, you're on the Chris Plant Show.
Hey, Chris, thanks. I think it matters a lot. It's the same reason, it's the same way that the Democrats can I guess, rewrite history and prove to the world or prove to everyone that the Republicans are the KKK. Huh. He who has the power...
Huh? Damn, and here I find myself another Wednesday without tequila. The Democrat? Where'd that come from? And look, we can't get 15 seconds into a caller conversation on a right-wing radio station talking about the President of the United States without an oblique reference to the Ku Klux Klan.
Or writes history. So if he can take God out of his speeches now, when next year or the year after or years from now, when they built...
Because he did. He took it right out there. He had his little pencil. And, no, I cannot tolerate under God for...
Start using his speech instead of Lincoln's speech.
Oh, what is this dart inside my neck? much better now. Oh, that inscrutable, that one in our White House. My, oh, my, oh, my. He's going to substitute his speech for the Gettysburg Address, and then it'll probably become part of Common Core, and little children will then... Oh, Jesus.
Oh, that's good. That's, and you know what? You're right.
Now wait all night for calls like these.
I mean, you know, here's the Gettysburg Address as delivered by Barack Obama. Becomes the new standard bearer for the Gettysburg Address. And
you know,
oops.
You got everyone else drinking Kool-Aid. So, I mean, if what he says is already true. So if he says it wasn't there, then it wasn't there.
You know,
of course, he didn't say it wasn't there. Now, I mean, this is sort of an exercise in just, oh, look what an idiot the right-wingers are. We do this a lot. But this is also a bit of a language and framing and perhaps a sociological exercise as well. Because you'll notice the fact that Ken Burns specifically requested the reading of the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address appears nowhere. And so the little wing nuts with what passed for brains just leaking out of and running down their necks and dribbling onto the floor. Ken Burns had nothing to just. Well, it's him, that one.
They go to
all of the misinformed people.
President Obama and his fellow travelers. Followers. There are followers of President Obama who have fought to have, for example, under God, taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance. All right, and they can't do that by fiat, but Barack Obama can do it by fiat here. And when he's going through
Ferrari?
What Barack Obama and his people have the Gettysburg Address in front of them, and they're sitting up in, you know, leather wing chairs at the White House with a red pencil going through the speech, and they scratch
and of course it has to be a red pencil. Actually, I think you'd use a blue one if I could, but no, it's red because they're, you know, Satan
out under God, and then pass it to Barack Obama and he reads it that way. I mean, how does something like this happen? How stupid are these people? How dishonest are these? How fundamentally corrupt, morally and otherwise corrupt, are these people? It's astonishing to me. And it just plays...
It would be astonishing if there was even a hen's tooth worth of truth in this. Holy, absolutely, utterly corrupt. Because I guess it's too much work for... Chris Planty, conservative radio host and frequent Fox News guest, to simply understand that there are two versions and that Barack Hussein Obama, as he describes him, was called upon to read one of them. Because it's ever so much fun to go after Barack Hussein Obama because you get to say Hussein a lot, you know, and that means he was probably Saddam's cousin, and then you say that a lot, and 'cause Ken Hussein Burns just doesn't have the same cachet, does it? Nope.
it's fun. The fundies you have always with you. And then, of course, and a number of you sent this story to me, including our buddy Tim from L.A. Profiles in Christian Courage. Dateline Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where Emmanuel Paulino has been taken into custody after first trying to fight the police, having raped a woman. I will spare you the details and say merely that there's no non-brutal rape. There's no friendly rape. There's no casual rape. Rape is rape. But apparently under the influence of something called Molly, the crystalline version of MDMA, which I find difficult to believe because MDMA has never been really documented as promoting violence or anything. But apparently the victim and as well as Emmanuel Paulino both took it and decided to engage in sex. At which point Emmanuel Paulino decided to transform it into rape that resulted in a woman being seriously physically harmed, intestinally damaged, and her screams were so awful that they brought her children into the room, at which point 911 was called. She was found in a fetal position, the victim was. So Emmanuel Paulino was arrested after some trouble. Emmanuel Paulino has a rap sheet that includes things like aggravated assault, aggravated indecent assault, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and sexual assault. He is presently charged. Oh, that is what he has been charged with. That's not his rap sheet. I apologize. That's just what he's been charged with. Aggravated assault, aggravated indecent assault, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and sexual assault. And aggravated assault was filed against him for headbutting the first officer who tried to take him into custody. Having been arrested, they took him before Magisterial District Judge James Dixon there in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. This was late last night. Being informed of the charges against him by the magistrate, and this is why this is a profile in Christian Courage, Emmanuel Paulino responded that he is not concerned about the charges against him because, and this is a quote, "I have Jesus on my side." That's right. Jesus is on the side of accused rapists whose victims suffer what are described as severe internal trauma. Jesus. And you know, he's right. I mean, that's the theology of Christianity. All he has to do is ask Jesus for forgiveness, and Jesus forgives him. It's all forgiven. Now, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania may take a slightly more stern view, one would hope, of the problem. But he's already been forgiven under Christian theology. Isn't that lovely? This gives you hope for the whole human race, doesn't it? Yeah. Tim from L.A. with a question. Hey, Bob. Isn't Costco a corporation, and didn't these same whining Christians support free market capitalism? Well, yes, they do. It's right there in the 13th chapter of the second book of Flip Floppians, I believe. Maybe they'll put the Bible in the porn section or toilet paper section next time. Oh, and there is a good use for the Bible. A college friend who landed in the California Department of Corrections in Chino, California, said, you can ask for all the Bibles you want. What's the Bible good for? You get the Bible with the really thin, thin pages. Awesome rolling paper. Thanks, Tim. And it is here at about 9 minutes before the hour on this prayer meeting Wednesday. It is time for our quote of the week. Coming from, well, we referenced it last week, the book of Hosea. He says, Bob, I know you like, Jay Cruzen says, Bob, I know you like the King James Version, but I can't give this one to you in the King James because that version took Israel out of the text. Why? I don't know. Maybe Betsy can tell you. And I think Betsy reminded us last week that the book of Hosea is sort of an after-the-fact argument about who's going to have power in the eternal disputes between Judah, the kingdom of Judah, and the kingdom of Israel. The glory of, this is Hosea 9:11 through 16. This is our reading this evening. The glory of Israel will fly away like a bird, for your children will die at birth, or perish in the womb, or never even be conceived. Even if your children do survive to grow up, I will take them from you. It will be a terrible day when I turn away and leave you alone. I have watched Israel become as beautiful and pleasant as Tyre, but now Israel will bring out her children to be slaughtered. O Lord, what should I request for your people? I will ask for wombs that don't give birth and breasts that give no milk. The Lord says, all their wickedness began at Gilgal. There I began to hate them. Man, that's tough when the Lord begins to hate you. I will drive them from my land because of their evil actions. I will love them no more because all their leaders are rebels. Way down yonder in the land of Gilgal. The people of Israel are stricken. Their roots are dried up. They will bear no more fruit. And if they give birth, I will slaughter their beloved children. Thus saith the God of love, the all-loving creator of the universe. And that is your bloodthirsty, all-loving creator of the universe quote for this week from our buddy Jay Cruz. Thank you kindly. And thank you, Jay Cruz. He helped out as did our buddy Sal to put us. Let's see. So Asa responded to Robert in Australia and matched that 50, and then Jay Cruzen and Betsy responded to Asa with that 50, and Sal has then responded thusly. And we're halfway to raising another matching 50, which is exactly the way that Robert was hoping it would play out in his note for this evening's Down Under, Up Over Australia Land of Oz Challenge. Thank you for getting it all started, Robert, and thank you, everybody, for participating. And then our buddy Luda has pushed it a little further. He has joined in. He says, here's a 50. Tell everyone to match it. My only condition is that you remind the listeners about Obama finally recognizing the last Native Code Talkers. What a great Native American Heritage Month. Thank you. So now we stand with $25 to go to match what has gone forward. And yes, President Obama did recognize the last Native Code Talkers. And it was a beautiful thing. Even the Republican and the Democratic member of the Senate found something to agree on in doing that, from Republican and Democratic member from South Dakota. Because everyone remembers that there were Navajo code talkers, but there were also Lakota code talkers and code talkers from other Native American tribes whose words were absolutely incomprehensible to the fascists on the other side of that world encompassing war. So yes, absolutely. It was recognition long overdue, and arguably in the bigger picture still not enough. Which brings me to some non-prayer meeting material. I found this over at a website called lastrealindians.com. You may recall that not last week, but the week before, there was a great tribal, a great big meeting of tribal leaders in Washington, D.C. And on November the 13th, President Obama and the administration held their fifth annual Tribal Nations Conference. Fifth annual. That means this has only been going on for as long as President Obama has been in office. Okay. First inclination is to say that's a step forward. That's not a bad idea. Sure. And President Obama came and addressed the leaders. I happened to have a conversation last week about this speech. I read some of the news reports about it, but I didn't note, I didn't see a lot of reportage in there in the for-profit media of the fact that some of those tribal leaders got up and walked the hell out. The story I'm reading at that website, lastrealindians.com, is by Matt Remley. Matt Remley writes, Obama addressed the conference attendees during the afternoon session, and towards the end of Obama's speech, he began talking about tribal lands, climate change, and energy development. His leaps from being, because there was all this stuff about how we must acknowledge that tribal peoples have always been good stewards of their land, and that they bear a special relationship with the land. That kind of stuff. Okay, that's good. We can all sort of work within those boundaries. But then, as Matt Remley writes, his leaps from being a good steward of native lands to the negative impacts on tribal lands from climate change to energy development. Oh, no. Energy development. This is a direct quote from the speech that Barack Obama gave to the fifth annual Tribal Nations Conference. And then the fourth area that we've got to work on is let's keep our covenant strong by being good stewards of native homelands, which are sacred to you and your families. I saw the beauty of Crow Agency, Montana, when I was a candidate for this office. Next year, I'll make my first trip to Indian country as president. Paren, applause, close paren. Really? 5 years in the office of the president. And he's while he's been all over the place, hasn't quite gotten around to visiting those last remaining little patches of ground that remain what is referred to as Indian country. The health of tribal nations depends on the health of tribal lands. So it falls on all of us to protect the extraordinary beauty of those lands for future generations. Oh, jeez. Where's the Secretary of Jesus, Barack? Didn't make the trip? No? Tell me if I'm wrong here, but tribal peoples are not into preserving what is left of their lands because they're pretty. If I listen, Angry Indian, Luda, if I get this wrong, square me up, okay? Because I don't want to I don't want to bobsplain this. But unless I've completely misunderstood everything that I have been trying very much to learn, Native peoples do not want to preserve their lands because they're pretty or because they have beauty, but because they themselves and their very lives on this planet, Turtle Island, for instance, is inextricably bound up with the land. The land belongs collectively to the people, and the people belong to the land. It is a wildly different understanding of inhabitants or habitation than the European model, which derived, of course, from the feudal model, where you can actually, in your puny little lifetime, own actual hunks of planet Earth, which, if you sit around and think about it without even anything in the way of mood or mind-altering substances, is absolutely ridiculous, stupid, silly, asinine, infantile. My land! My land! Mommy's got my land! So the preservation of what little remains of what was once an entire hemisphere successfully lived upon, and more successfully than anywhere else on the planet, by the way, and arguably more brilliantly lived upon, and lived within, and lived around, and lived among, is reduced to, you need to save your lands because it's pretty and tourists like to come to it. So it falls on all of us to protect the extraordinary beauty of those lands for future generations. I don't think the whole seven generations idea is about pretty. It is about obligations. It is about both heritage and honoring those who have held up their end of the bargain before. And already, many of your lands have felt the impacts of changing climate, including more extreme flooding and droughts. That's why, as part of the Climate Action Plan, I announced this year, my administration is partnering with you to identify where your lands are vulnerable to climate change, how we can make them more resilient. And I saw a story today about how the Obama administration has parceled out a pissant little puny $7 million on the one hand to help some tribes go to solar energy, and on the other hand, with the Menominee people in Wisconsin, they've given out some money to help them build biomass burners, which will, of course, produce ultrafine particulate matter, and, well, we know the rest. Then this. And working together, we want to develop the energy potential of tribal lands in a responsible way and in accordance with tribal wishes. Notice how it's we want to and then tribal wishes. You'll notice tribals don't have determinations. Tribals don't have laws. Tribal peoples do not have demands. They have wishes. I wish you people would leave our land alone. Well, wish in one hand and in the other. Because over the last 4 years, we've more than doubled oil and gas revenues on tribal lands, a big reason why the United States is now more energy independent. Facepalm. And Matt Remley writes, incredible, in a mere matter of minutes he leapfrogs from being good stewards of the land to the impacts already felt by climate change to we want to develop the energy potential of tribal lands. Matt Ranley continues, certainly Obama is referring in part to the massive expansion of the Bakken Shale Formation in North Dakota and the widespread expansion of the hydraulic fracturing that has occurred under his watch in the lead and leading to the U.S. being more energy independent. He continues to note, in North Dakota since 2012, there have been over 300 oil spills that had previously gone unreported. Man camps, havens of illicit drug use, violence, and sex trafficking have exploded around the oil fields. The United States reaching a state of more energy independence has come at the expense of tribal lands, communities, and waterways. And may I add, the air they breathe. Still working on that air thing. Across Turtle Island, communities have literally dried up due to hydraulic fracturing, and in communities where water still flows, it has become so polluted that, as numerous YouTube videos can testify, you can light it on fire. Since European contact, the aims of the colonists have been simple. Remove and or assimilate indigenous populations to gain greater access to lands and resources to exploit for profit. Regardless of who has held the presidency, this simple truth has remained. So we want to help protect them from protect tribal lands from climate change, extreme droughts, flooding, what have you, by drill baby drilling. Really? President Not Sure went to the Tribal Nations Conference and said, drill baby drill. Why not just send Sarah Palin? Moments like this, you kind of feel a little screwed. A lot screwed. And, of course, nobody gets a pass because it turned out at this tribal conference when Gina McCarthy showed up, the administrator of the EPA, there were apparently Republican Indians in attendance. Who, never mind that whole seven generations thingy, were saying things like, and it comes straight from people like the American Clean Coal Coalition, whatever, we've got to have more certainty on our tribal lands. You've got to give us more time to develop clean coal technology, because remember, there are tribal peoples who have sold out God knows how many acres for strip mining in places like Montana or Arizona. The snaky serpentine fingers of the coal and oil and gas industries go everywhere and can pervert everything. The practice of showing up with a barrel of liquor of 125, 150 years ago has been replaced by the practice of showing up with a barrel of liquor and a few drilling trucks and drilling rigs. This just... Is it really that hard to conceptualize the idea that we don't have to destroy the ability of human beings to live on this planet? I know it isn't that hard to conceptualize, because that is a concept that is shared almost universally among the Horn family commune. For heaven's sakes. Why? Because money. Because money. Has the Sierra Club sent out a fundraising letter about saving tribal lands yet? I'm surprised if they haven't. Oh, well. But that's not where it ends. Oh, no. No, no. Let's stay with the topic for just another minute or so. Let us go back to Alabamistan. How can we ever leave it for very long? Now, you know that another member of Congress, and I can't remember the name right up because I don't have the story right in front of me, has stood up to say that it really is time to ditch the Redskins' name of the Washington, D.C. football team. Good. On the other hand, it's worth noting that there's still trouble on the local level. A couple or three stories here. Like I said, the first one comes out of Alabamistan. It comes from McAdory High School, who was hosting a home game against Pinson Valley High School. Pinson Valley High School is unfortunately named the Indians, which is bad enough. But because students like to get into the spirit of things, they had a run-through banner at McAdory High School for the heroic fighting whatevers of the McAdory High School football team to run through at the beginning of the game. The sign said, "Hey, Indians, get ready to leave in a trail of tears." No, really. Really, really, really. "Hey, Indians, get ready to leave in a trail of tears." There are several obvious analogies, which I will leave to you. Hey, fill in the blank, get ready to do, you know, whatever has been right. Yeah. And by the way, there is a little bit of a happy ending to this story. Because when the story hit social media and people began objecting and pointing out how utterly repugnant, how wholly repulsive it is to suggest that an athletic contest will be a reenactment of an act of outright genocide, the school district stepped up and apologized in the person of McAdory High School Principal Todd Humphreys, who said of the sign, "This was not condoned by the school administration, the Jefferson County Board of Education, or the community. The person who would normally be responsible for approving such signs is out on maternity leave, and I take full responsibility that arrangements were not made to have the signs pre-approved before the ball game. Please accept our sincere apologies to the Native American people and to anyone who was offended by the reference." See, we got it again. The non-apology apology. The "if you were offended." Apologies to anyone who... No. See, teachable moment for Principal Todd Humphreys. You don't apologize if anybody was offended. You just apologize. We were wrong. we're sorry. We won't do it again. But in the but then, can we have an English language moment here? Please accept our sincere apologies to the Native American people and to anyone who was offended by the reference to an event that is a stain on our nation's past forever. A stain on our nation's past forever. This is a high school principal. How about any by the reference to an event that will forever remain a stain on our nations, our nation? There are things up with which I will not put. They're taking additional steps at McAdory High School. The social studies and history teachers are going to reteach or review lessons on the 1830 Indian Removal Act that created the Trail of Tears, or at least such portions of the act that are covered by standardized testing, because we all know how that works. And then there is the problem that the folks at Think Progress note, in that one dehumanizes a group of people when one reduces them to mascots, along the lines of the Philly fanatic, or generic bulldogs, or tigers. You know, say whatever you will about the Alabama Crimson Tide or the Harvard Crimson. There's at least nothing offensive about it. Crimson. Crimson Tide. You know how the Alabama Crimson Tide got their nickname, right? Yeah. Their logo is an elephant. Because once upon a time in the early days of college football, the football team was invited to go and play at the Rose Bowl, which was the only postseason bowl at the time. And their trunks for all their equipment came from a Birmingham company that provided travel cases. And the little name tags that went on the handles of the trunks, were in the form of elephants. And that is how the Alabama Crimson Tide has a mascot that is sort of incongruously an elephant for something named the Crimson Tide, because the Crimson Tide comes from a newspaper story by a very creative writer of English words, who said that the Alabama squad, who were wearing jerseys of crimson, the Alabama squad moved down the field like a crimson tide. Hence, Roll Tide Roll, which is all I have left this college football season, being as how my beloved Mountaineers are engaged in the apparently wholly committed act of being utterly, utterly hopeless. Oh, this update from Texas Betsy. My reference to not teaching much of the Indian Removal Act of 1830 because it's not on the standardized test. No. I stand corrected. In Texas Betsy, this is the most trenchant observation. No, Bob. They'll teach the lessons in place of electives, and the kids will end up blaming Indians for their loss of PE. That is how these things work. I could be out smoking dope behind the field house, but I got to sit in here and listen to it because of that damn sign. See? Like that. Meanwhile, in the state of Wisconsin, it ain't just Alabama anymore. Meanwhile, in the state of Wisconsin, a member of that state's legislature, who is, of course, a Republican, has proposed a bill that will make it something right next door to impossible for anybody in that state to complain about a school mascot being an abuse of Native or anybody else's cultural heritage. I wish I was kidding. However, I am not. Under this new law, anyone objecting to, say, the, I don't know, Rhinelander fighting Chippewas, will have to gather a number of petition signatures equal to one-tenth of the entire student population of the district in question. Because we all know that the actual abuse that's taking place is of the well-meaning white folks who just want to honor Native peoples by referring to them as, you know, mascots. Aren't you charmed? Because I'm not. But every now and then somebody will push back. And I was really, if I can find the daggum story, I was kind of proud to see the pushback that was involved in this particular case. Because a Democratic legislator of color from Wisconsin, from the Milwaukee area, said, this is just wrong. If it's not okay to call a team the team mascot the N-word or the Asian slur or the homosexual slur, she said, then it is also not okay to refer to people as warriors or Indians or savages or red men or redskins, which is absolutely and undeniably true. But this thing will, given the nature of the Wisconsin legislature, run right through, well, it did, like through a goose, and slide all slickety-like right onto the desk of Governor Scott Walker, who I'm sure will be more than happy to sign it into law so that people's rights to co-opt and marginalize entire cultures. Because freedom. Wolverines! I love it when the football fans get involved. Dr. John. Okay, Crimson Tide. That makes a certain amount of sense. Now explain the whole Auburn Tiger War Eagle thing, smart guy. I'm licked. I'm a Tide fan. I know that history. I'm helpless on that one, Dr. John. I really am. They are the Auburn Tigers, but their chant, much like no matter how hapless they are, we sit in the stands in Morgantown and holler, "Let's go, Mountaineers," or Notre Dame fans holler, "Let's go, Irish." Auburn fans sit in the stands and holler, "War Eagle," and they are the Auburn Tigers, but they have an eagle, a golden eagle, which is their mascot, which flies around the stadium and then returns to the arm of the... Yeah. Yeah. While we're at it, Fighting Irish. Why isn't there another school that's like the Fighting Italians? Or the Fighting Frenchmen? Dunno. So, but then again, LSU fans are fans of the Bayou Bengals. Hint, there are no Bengals in Bayous. It's just, but that means it's at least completely made up. It's not real. Whereas Indians, Chippewas, Redskins, these are actual real human beings. Also, Dr. John pointing out under the subject line, missed it by that much. Principal Whatsis came so close to an actual apology. Partial credit, though. Yeah, that's one of those participation trophies, isn't it, Dr. John? Texas Betsy noting under the rubric of non-apologies, apologies. One of my rabbis gave me a non-apology recently and then offered to meet about the issue that was bothering me. I told her I wasn't ready, but let me know when her perspective changes. Yeah, she needed time to explain. You know. And those are my favorite apologies. The, I'm sorry you're offended, let me explain to me why you're wrong to be offended. But those are classic. Note from Jeremy in Vermont, back to his address to the Tribal Nations Gathering. Subject line, Mr. President. Wait just one goddamn minute, Mr. Obama. Aren't all lands in danger or damage from climate change? And if so, shouldn't all lands be freaking protected? And let's keep the energy killers off the lands? Well, that's a cubic meter of gas too far, Jeremy. Tim from L.A. with a note regarding the Trail of Tears. When I attended college, I never knew about the Trail of Tears until I attended college. And in my Asian American Studies class, my professor did a comparison contrast on oppression upon people of color. Going from K-12 in Los Angeles, I knew nothing. It was only in college where I learned about the bloody past. To answer Betsy's remark, if ethnic studies were part of the curriculum from K-12, suffice to say that the banner would not have happened, and her school, like every other school, would have PE so kids can blaze behind the gym using the Bible as rolling paper, maybe. Not in Alabama, Tim. Not in Alabama. Oh, no. Even your serious stoners won't use them. No. Okay. The sports teams of the local Jewish school down in Texas Betsy's neck of the woods is called the Maccabees. Please, Betsy, please tell me. I mean, are there enough students there to field a football team? Please tell me the helmet doesn't have a little menorah on it. Please. No little menorahs on the baseball team or the soccer jerseys. Or please. Huh. Why? Somebody, anybody, why? Volleyball and basketball and soccer. I'm still waiting. No menorahs. I'd really need to see no menorahs. Blue jerseys in the school's initials. Okay, I'm feeling much better. Luda with a note. Damn it, Bob, you being a fan of the shit Eastern Conference might be a deal-breaker. Vandy and Kentucky are real powerhouses, and don't worry, as Native people, or skins, we're used to being abused, no one ever cares about us. We're the only race left that white folks have free range to discriminate against. I beg to differ. Okay, well, see, that's the problem. We're using the word race, and we know race is an artificial construct. Anyway, let me finish. Luda says, how would white Americans feel about an NFL team called the Mick Krauts or the Slaveholders? Because, after all, they're honoring their past as America, right? Well, sure, but only so far. But let me back up for a minute. I was over at Americans Against the Tea Party today. I get their updates, and I read their stories and so forth. And I posted a comment on one because it was something. It was a story. It was an opinion piece about teabaggers wanting to get rid of, repeal the 17th Amendment that calls for the popular election of the members of the Senate. Because a good while back, that was one of those things in the Constitution that was recognized to be not working at all well, letting the legislatures engage in grift, graft, and otherwise other forms of corruption. So and picking the members of the Senate that way. So the writer of this article used in the first word of the first sentence of the first paragraph of the body of his piece the word teabillies. Race as a construct is a problem, and it is separate from the idea of ethnicity. And then there are cultural heritage groups. I, for instance, am a hillbilly. I come from Appalachia. So did the other eight generations before me. So do the two generations after me. And it is annoying to see someone who is trying to craft an objection to a group of people who are patently stupid, ignorant, uninformed, bigoted, arrogant, autocratic, you know, the Tea Party. I mean, why don't we just call them what they are, the John Birch Society? Because they are. They're just a rebranded John Birch Society. And in conveying his disdain, and as the tool for conveying his disdain, smears my ethno-heritage group. I mean, I got problems all day long with a lot of really dumb people here. But the stupid you have always with you. This is Prayer Meeting Wednesday, after all. And stupid's all over the place. Oh, and by the way, I got to back up. Let's be clear about this. I'm not a Southeastern Conference fan. I can't even bring myself to be a Big 12 Conference. My beloved university, my alma mater, and Alabama's my alma mater, too. But WVU is in the Big 12 Conference, which makes about as much sense to me as, oh, kickstands on tanks, screen doors on submarines, right. But I am a proud son of the Capstone, as well as a proud son of Harvard on the Mon. So that's how that works out. But let's not broaden that out too far to be the whole Southeastern Conference. But yeah, the fact of the matter is Kentucky is a powerhouse in basketball, but we'll leave that alone. So that's, that's a start for the evening, isn't it? I think, daggummit. I don't know what it is that makes the chat room collapse on me. I didn't mean to disappear like that. I apologize. Hey, I tell you what. We are halfway through the program. We do like to call what we do here Conversation Radio. We are halfway to having another $50 challenge met. So that's very helpful. It really, we need to get up near $500 in order to come even so bills can be paid. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Edward. How are you?
I'm fine. I had set the phone down and I had the speakerphone on. Well, I just want to tell you, you probably won't hear this on the news or anything, but west of Fort Worth, there were three small earthquakes yesterday.
Do tell.
How about that? And some of the people are complaining because their walls are cracking.
Oh, I'll be darned. Reckon why that would be happening somewhere west of Fort Worth.
Why, I wouldn't have any idea.
I mean, they wouldn't be fracking over there now, would they?
probably.
I mean, they're fracking every loose square inch of ground in Texas, aren't they?
Trying to. So far, they haven't come over here where we live, but, I mean, that's the next place for them to arrive.
I remember when somebody told me that the campus of SMU actually has a functioning oil well on it.
It does.
Well, then what's wrong with having a fracking rig in your front yard, Edward? I mean, apart from everything.
Other than the fact that they would have to take me to the mental institution and put me in a padded room.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I probably would act real ugly. You know, and one thing I wanted to point out, You have another person who calls, Edward. His name is Edward.
Or at least emails.
Well, anyway, I might change my name slightly. My name is, and don't laugh, because it's a Southern name. My name is Edward Earl.
No, I wouldn't laugh. No, never.
Well, anyhow,
E. I mean, that's got real style to it, Edward.
Well, yeah, but my last name is with a C, so it spells Eek. Oh well. Anyway, I thought I'd change my name to Ed Earl.
Ed Earl.
You know who Ed Earl was?
No. Help me out.
Okay. Ever heard of the Chicken Ranch?
Absolutely.
Well, he was the sheriff who was the friend of the madam there at the Chicken Ranch. His name was Ed Earl. So I can call myself Ed Earl.
Absolutely.
And if we get into a bad thing, I can maybe... No, they wouldn't bring me any chickens. Oh, well.
I don't think chicken was the whole point of the process. Was it?
No, it wasn't. But she it brought the chicken ranch out of the depression, because the madam took the chickens because the boys didn't have any money, so she took chickens in payment for their services there.
You reckon that's where that woman in Nevada got her idea of take a chicken to the doctor?
Probably, but it was the chicken ranch here in Texas, and they had a real good thing going. I mean, they weathered the depression and made a lot of boys happy.
I reckon so. I do reckon so. Well, I hope you don't have any more. I hope the earthquakes don't get any nearer, and I hope they don't put one in your front yard neither.
Well, I hope so. And there were two on what do they call it? Richter scale 2. And then one was a 3. That's not bad yet. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff down under that ground here in Texas that we better watch out about.
Because, right, there are some things that are better left alone.
Yeah, and especially that aquifer. I mean, if that thing gets poisoned, we're gone. Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma.
Oh, the Ogallala, yeah, the Ogallala aquifer? Yes, indeed.
Ogallala, let me tell you, if it goes, we're done for.
Absolutely toast.
Yeah. Well, you all take care. I just wanted to call and tell you about our little earthquakes today.
Well, I appreciate it, and you have yourself a good evening.
I will, and if somebody calls in and calls themselves Ed Earl, you know it's from the Chicken Ranch.
Hear, hear.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Chicken Ranch. Let's keep it moving. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's really great to follow the Duke of Earl.
There's another one.
Yeah.
What's happening, Bill?
Well, not much, but I was thinking of these names. How about the Berlin Panzers.
Well, there you go.
There's a hell of a soccer team, ain't it?
Dr. John just went running down the Google hole, and he found us probably the oddest of all college mascots.
Hmm.
The Scottsdale, Arizona Community College Fighting Artichokes.
That sounds like a bunch of people that I would have known in the 60s who would have come with a name like that.
Dude, let's be the Artichokes.
Well, the whole thing, Bob, and this use of... Well, that Washington team was a great team before I got into the game, and they were pretty mediocre for a while. But I'll tell you what, the truth of the matter was from 50 to through 55, I didn't think there was another team in the Eastern Division, in the National Football League. You know, that's how it is when you're a kid. You grow up with a home team that was magnificent in its day.
Yeah, the Browns.
Oh. So I had the privilege of meeting the coach twice, and Mr. Brown once, the running back, and...
Oh, Mr. Brown, yes.
Yes, sir.
Jim.
Man, there was a guy from your home state, too, who was a pain in Cleveland Browns' butts.
Oh, you would be referring to Sam Huff.
Yes, yes.
I think Jim Brown still hates him.
Well, he was one of the few guys that could handle Jim. I mean, I hate to tell you how many times you'd see Jim go into the line, come out carrying a lineman and a linebacker and shake them off like a dog coming out of a bathtub. Just shake, and here these two big guys are sliding away. And oh, man, I can't tell you enough about it. Watch his. And the problem is the filming of the games in those days was pretty bad. Well, you know, early TV filming was poor.
To say the least.
What was it? They had a name for what the process they used.
What, kinescope?
Kinescope. Thank you, sir. Because sometimes I can't remember everything. I just came from dinner where we were at the...
Well, it's worth noting, for those who don't know, that Jim Brown and Sam Huff's relationship predated their NFL rivalry.
Yeah, Sam played for West Virginia, right?
And every year they played against Syracuse.
Yeah.
And it was understood every time they played Syracuse that if Jim Brown took a step, Sam Huff would take a mirroring step. I mean, the other 10, it was as if the other 10 West Virginia players were playing one game, and Sam Huff's only job was to slobber knock Jim Brown.
Yeah. Was he able to handle him in college that well?
Oh, yeah.
No wonder New York grabbed him. Because that was the rivalry in the Eastern division of the NFL through the 50s.
And Jim, Jim complains, I think, to this day that Sam played dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, he...
cheap shots.
Yeah. Well, all running backs thought everybody took a cheap shot. It was part of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, defining cheap shot in that era is 95% of the football that got played before 1978 was cheap shots, or up to and including the Raiders of that dynasty.
Yeah.
And by the way, the use of Duncan in the chat room pointing out, don't forget the University of California Santa Cruz, the Fighting Banana Slugs. But the University of San Diego State or UC San Diego? Aren't they still the Aztecs?
One was the Aztecs, and I can't remember. I had a book of comedic stuff that came out in the late 50s, and what was hip and what wasn't. And according to the writers of this book, following elephant ball was much hipper than following college. Because I got into pro ball long before college. I just, to this day, of course, collegiate ball is a lot different today. I mean, there's some players down there that, you know, I realize they... Hell, I had a book that was published for kids. It was titled Key Quarterback of a Small College School that hires a former pro coach, and the next thing you know, they got a bunch of players that are walk-ons and older guys than the guys that played before. And in other words, these guys, some of them had been pros, and they came back to play for a college team in this book for teenagers, you know, to point out how crooked that was and how bad it was. And there was a lot going on even those days. I know Hallis got popped for paying a guy to take out Bobby Lane. You know, that the deal that they had in Florida, that happened in either 56 or 7. It must have been 56, because I think by 7, Lane had left Detroit and gone over to Pittsburgh with a guy named Buddy Parker, who was the coach that he had worked for at Detroit. Because that era, from 50 to 55, only three teams made the championship game. Eastern Division Browns every damn year, and it was either L.A. or the Detroit Lions.
Yep.
I mean, that was a kind of a funny league in those days. And New York had two coaches that were shadowing Brown like they were Pinkertons. And one was Vince Lombardi, and the other was the Dallas coach, Tom Landry. That was their job, was almost to study what Paul was doing. He was only rated number 11 on the Sports Network list of coaches, but I'll tell you what, when he was doing what he was doing, he was way ahead of everybody else. And Chuck Noll was one of his students, and a few other guys who, Weeb Eubank, who beat New York in that game scene around the world, you know?
Yeah,
so Paul had his thing, and he was damn good at it. When he coached Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and he saw a lot of these guys when they were in the service. So he had a long memory and a big notebook, and he kept track of players pretty hard, and it was a whole different thing. But getting back to this ethnic thing, I remember the whole idea of some of these names that are handed out, and I hate to say it, but Washington is always, not always, but so many years it had a great franchise, but I think it's a little offensive. What's your opinion?
No, it's a lot offensive.
Yeah, it's a lot offensive.
Until, and really the comparison, although I'm sure the right wingers and who, you know, that's political correctness, apparently are incapable of understanding the comparison. The fact of the matter is, you would never get away with using some other derogatory ethnic slur to describe a sports mascot.
Yeah. There's a limit. I mean, Indians are bad enough.
Braves, yeah, you mean using the word, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Braves, not as bad. But, yeah, Redskins is just too much.
Well, even something like the term Braves has an offensive quality to it, because it manifests a complete lack of understanding of that social structure which existed, in which the warrior or the brave or and all of these things are, well, I guess what I'm getting at is all of these things are fundamental English misunderstandings of philosophically oriented cultural traditions.
Yeah.
I saw a quote from Sitting Bull earlier today about what warrior means. And he says it doesn't mean somebody who goes out and kills people. It means someone who protects the rest of the group.
Yeah. Well, that was the theory behind it when you were in cultures where there was plenty of action to be go around. Everybody seemed to have a reason to go fight with somebody else, you know. God knows the Europeans found good reasons or adequate reasons, because they sure did it enough.
Sure, and they brought it over here, and lo and behold, they used the North American and South American continents as blood-soaked proxy grounds for fights that they were undertaking in Europe. I mean, the so-called French and Indian War.
The Queen Anne's, yeah.
Well, that was just an extension of the ongoing state of hostilities between Britain and France.
That was a good hustle in bars and colleges to ask somebody, well, who won the French and Indian War, French or the Indians? You know.
Right.
And they'd say, well, they come up with an answer.
Isn't it funny how the British get a dodge out of that? And, of course,
these things
have broader meaning, Bill, because that war, the need to pay for the tremendous cost of a war on the other side of the planet is part of the reason that when it was all over with, the British Crown said, we'd like to impose some taxes on you colonists for having just saved your useless hides.
Yeah. Well, the colonists...
And that's where all that business about we don't want to pay taxes came from. In other words, we want the defense of the colonies for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, frankly, putting up your butt to save their colonies, well, you were trying to save your own butt, maybe. Because the average guy on the frontier had a little to say about how that war started or how it continued. That was the boys back in Europe were finding, well, they wanted to fight over that land in Canada, you know.
Yeah.
The British wanted, French and British. How the French and British ever were allied in, you know, the First and Second World War, I'll never understand, because they always seem to find a way to fight each other.
Well, no, the way that works out, Bill, is that the British position was that they would always oppose whichever power looked to be gaining the hegemonic upper hand.
Yeah.
So in 1914, that was Germany. So therefore, Britain opposed Germany. But in previous centuries, when it was France gaining the hegemonic upper hand, it was Britain and Spain against France. When it was Spain that was gaining the hegemonic upper hand, it was Britain against Spain.
The pirates of the Bounding Main sure lived off of the Spanish, didn't they?
Oh, privateering?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's so weird when you go back and look at this stuff. Woody Guthrie's great line is, "Through this world I travel, I see lots of funny men, some rob you with a six-gun," and you know the rest, Bob.
Yes, indeed.
And right now, a lot's being stolen at the end of a fountain pen from the citizens in this country.
J.P. Morgan Chase?
Yeah.
Now, there was big ballyhoo made out of the fact that they're going to pay a $13 billion fine. But that was a $13 billion fine that Jamie Dimon told the federal government that they were willing to pay. The fact of the matter is, their liabilities were something closer to $200 billion. In other words, 20% of $1 trillion, which is what they actually should have been forced to pay.
Yeah, they got a nice bargain on that one, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, I remember when a coal company in West Virginia, Massey, was about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, and they paid five. And then the West Virginia government turned around and said, "And you know what? You can pay it in rocks."
Oh.
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, brother.
Straight out of the Flintstones. "Why don't you pay us in rocks?"
Jesus Christ.
And, of course, I'm sure Massey got to determine the value of the rocks at par based on their retail, not wholesale value. And it's it's similar to what J.P. Morgan Chase is going to get away with, because not only are they going to pay their paltry $13 billion, they're going to laugh all the way back to the bank, because then they're going to turn around and write it off their taxes.
Yeah. Yeah,
so you know, they give with one hand and they take with the other.
Yeah, they do well with both hands. You're right. And I don't know how long, I'll be long gone before the people here wake up to that, if ever. And
Bill, I think a lot of people are awake to it, but what they don't see is any means of correcting
it. Do anything about it.
Yeah.
Because you're going about it with the AIC Act, you're trying to use the legitimate political process.
Well, we're trying to use the political process. The jury's out on legitimate.
Well, that's...
You know my meaning.
Put some parenthesis around that word.
Yes.
Yeah, because is it a statement or a question? I don't know. I know theoretically what it's supposed to be, but it does come back as a question.
Yeah.
And I just... A buddy of mine stopped by today. We hit the good old Vietnamese restaurant. That pad thai never fails to be good.
Oh, no. It's always yummy.
And I passed along a Gibson... A late 40s Gibson with an 8 or a 10-inch speaker that I bought in 75 for 10 bucks, and went in and had to take all those leaky capacitors out, and, you know, the wax capacitors, and change them over. But this guy's done me so many favors that I wanted it. You know, you hate to leave something where movers can get their hands on it and stuff I'm not using anymore.
Right.
I'm not playing either electric or, you know, with any kind of... And I have a little thing about the size of a cigar box called a pod, where you can dial up different amp sounds and plug it into the PA. It's usable.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have nothing like that. That old Gibson, that thing used to howl, man. That was the... Because the old Chicago guys were all using, you know, in the 50s, they were using the most inexpensive things they could find. And because this was an idea to make a living, not spend a living. That was the theory behind the
plan. Well, there's that, and also the fact that this was before the days of the endorsement deal.
Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't cut a deal on anything. I never, some of my friends have endorsed stuff, harmonica players, in the, but I never bothered. I wouldn't bother with it. I can't endorse anything. Because the only thing I can endorse is go listen. And listen hard to what you're hearing. But I don't know, you got, I missed a lot of the monologue tonight. Was it basically what I caught at the tail end with the Native American?
It's prayer meeting, so we had the we had the usual and sundry abuses as committed by the Bible believing followers of the Prince of Peace.
Oh yeah, right. Those guys. Yeah. Well, you can't do anything with them there. The one woman who runs this building, she's into that stuff heavy, and I don't think she likes me because my reputation is not real good around here. With the, how come you never go to church? Look, they got enough of my money, you know. Once, I did go, you know, when you're a kid going to parochial.
Yeah, how come I never go to church? How come you never go to school?
Yeah, that's true too.
I mean, that's like the old bumper sticker, a favorite of mine. Don't pray in our schools, and we promise not to think in your churches.
Yeah, well, that's one I haven't seen, but that was a big thing going on, and. I know Catholics complained about paying taxes for public schools when they sent their kids to parochial. But on the other hand, my grandmother pulled her five kids out of a church in the midway through the 19, you know, the kids were born from 1908 with my mother. She was the last of the five. So when they were going to church and school, and the local yokel started telling her how much money to put in the, you know, for the kids and that. They quit. And, quit going to parochial school. And I went there, and I'll tell you what, one of the best parochial schools when I was in it was $100 a year. Now it's up in the thousands. Because now you know what they don't get anymore?
What?
Nuns, brothers, to teach schools.
Yeah, for next to nothing.
Yeah, exactly. No. And we actually had a couple of teachers that were good, but as I say, one of my male non-sectarian teachers called me an occupational hazard to a history teacher. Yeah, because I kept coming up with questions to ask him. Shut up and write down what I tell you. Keep that notebook. Copy down what I tell you, you'll get an A in the notebook, you know, and... That's a big part of your grade. Yeah, right. Because we know too much. I'll get off the phone here, but yeah, I didn't... when you were talking about the mascot issue, God, I can just see a... When I see a Berlin German soccer team, you know, the pickle hue helmet, and... what a thought, you know. I said, in the irony of history, when I read...
Well, how about here's one for America. How about the St. Ignatius Inquisitors?
Well, one of the best high school teams in the state of Ohio, you just named. Because you know why it's got that name? Because of Ignatius of Loyola and the Jesuits, who were probably one of the brainiest groups of RCs, you know? In fact, John Carroll University is a Jesuit school. Ignatius is probably the best.
Yeah, but you think maybe somebody would get pissed off, Bill, if they were named the Inquisitors?
They wouldn't like that.
Or how about the let me think of another saint. How about the Saint Joan of Arc stake lighters?
Oh.
I bet you old that creepy old Bill Donahue would be out there picketing, you know, yesterday.
Yeah.
How dare you spit on our hair? I mean, because they get their maiden forms in a bunch if you deliver them a cold cup of coffee.
Well, if you tell the partial truth about things, because that's my one feeling about religious fanatics who are wrong-headed. I don't care what the end result is. The name of the guy that they're worshiping. The activities may be the same. Now, there's a problem. They've had a problem in, areas of New York City that are the guys with the...
Hey, how about the St. Paul's Crucifiers?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. I think they nailed down first place, huh? Sorry.
Oh, you know what? You talk about how you feel like you're, you know, just not quite in front of the beat.
Yeah.
You know what? You ain't lost a lick. You haven't... No, you're not...
Well...
They got first place nailed down.
R&B place.
Toaster!
Thank you. A lot of us, you know, playing behind the beat was a secret of that stuff, too. If you listen to Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming, the horn licks from the Memphis Horns, that da 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 da, the beat is almost dragging, but it's propelling at the same time. And the story I heard on those guys from a drummer I had who has a degree in conducting, and not on the bus either,
You mean he didn't have a nickel squirter?
No, I had one of those when I was paper routing, of course, and he had to have one of those. And now I think, I don't know, look, when they, you know, I won't even mention how when you order something from McDonald's, that order goes all the way, I believe, to Colorado and back.
You're kidding.
No, I'm pretty sure I had heard this years ago that it's transmitted. And of course...
For inventory management and control?
Well, maybe. That's what they're saying. And the other thing is cash registers who have pictures that have pictures on them. It's like, are you shitting me?
No, they really do.
Yeah, I know they do. It's like, well... but playing slightly behind the beat was something that... you like to get, and if you listen to that horn part there, and the other story I had heard again from this guy with the 2 degrees in music, and was that the pitch of the instruments was slightly funny to give it a highly, but it was in tune, but it had this highly identified, you know, all the stacks of old horn stuff that was on like all of the Sam and Dave stuff, and how many other great performers that were on that label. And our buddy from Ohio here, he knows that stuff real well. It's always a pleasure when I talk to him, because his knowledge of music makes me feel like an idiot. But that's, a lot of people can do that. And I'll get off the phone, because I've been an idiot long enough for tonight.
Yeah, well, I don't think you've done that in all the time we've been talking thus far,
no. But I'll let you go, because you guys were into something, and I always appreciate it when I hear, like Edward, he was on the ball tonight. He's got a great sense of humor.
Oh, doesn't he?
This is the kind of stuff, Bob, when you can somehow retain a chuckle and keep fighting against the crap. That's the morale booster that you need, is to... something to stick you with the idea to keep going against something. Because you're, you know, like the situation you're in with the ACAC, that's a tough one. It shouldn't be one sight of the kids.
Yeah, and I mean, it truly is an uphill struggle. I mean, the fact of the matter, the reality of it is that we are so broke right now that, the 8 campaign is so broke right now, we can't afford for me to go up there and work. And there's been plenty of work being done, and it's been being done by one person. Because that, and you know, well,
and anybody who can argue against what you're in favor of, what you're arguing against, what the hell are they doing walking this earth? Get out of here, you know. Because it's, we thought we were past so many things. I mean. But I don't know. Sometimes I see what's going on here, and these guys want to take us back to what did Mark Twain call it? The Gilded Age.
Right. And he did not mean that as a compliment.
No. And me, I have a hard time with people who can't get enough money. Because at times in my life, I was delighted because I didn't need, well, I guess when you're born in a project situation, you lived in that, maybe your tastes are not quite as good, but I ate in some of the best restaurants in this area and did it a lot, Bob. I wasn't, many years were very pleasant. And the people I'm working with now, in this situation with this building, they do not like management here. And so that's in my favor, and I appreciate it. And I have to watch myself around here. I can't walk past the office and tell the one fundy what I think of what she believes in, because that isn't going to help me.
That's one of those first law of holes situations, Bill. Yeah. When you're in one, quit digging.
You got it. You ain't going to make it any better. You can't believe I'm sinking. Look at the hole I'm in. You can't believe something. Look at the fool I've been. I can't believe I love you. Look at the fool I've been. Yeah, some great lines out of that music. And if you dig deep enough, and you don't have to dig too far deep into country music and come up with some of the same emotions, you know, the old-timers in particular. Well, one song I did was Moving On, Hank Snow's old song, but I picked it up from a great version that Ray Charles did. Because that's America at its best, when different groups of songs are being passed around the family, you know?
Right.
Anyway, you take care.
All right, you have a good evening, Bill.
Good night.
Bye now. That's our buddy Mr. Stress calling from Cleveland. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Jerry?
I had never had a chance to call him last night, but I thought I'd add a little more to that caldera that we call Yellowstone.
Yes.
It's 300 miles long, completely filled with lava. So when it blows up, and they're no longer saying if, they're saying when.
When, yes.
It's raising itself. The whole park is raising up by 2 inches a year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but geologically, that's huge.
Well, pretty soon, it's going to stretch thin enough that it's going to rupture somewhere.
Yes, and that's their point. And being such a large caldera, it's not going to be a peaceful little, you know, like, bleh. It's going to be a big bang. And a great portion of this country is going to feel its wrath really quickly. And a large portion of those people probably won't stand a chance, because you can't move as fast as a pyroclastic flow moves.
Well, you can't move as fast as enough dust to dump a foot of ash in, you know, Utah.
Right.
And 11 feet of the stuff in Wyoming and Montana, and yeah.
They're actually saying that the flow that will be killing people is the same stuff that got places like Pompeii. It's the pyroclastic flow. Basically, it's that super hot, like 1,000-degree dust, which envelops everything it touches. And that'll be, like they said, 11, maybe, they might have even said 20 feet deep in most places within 1,000 miles of Yellowstone. So that's coming. They don't know when, but they know it's coming. And it could be tomorrow, it could be 1,000 years, they say. But it's definitely something that's going to be fun. The other thing I heard was that Japan suffered some earthquakes the other day.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I just got a note from Isaac noting that according to the Columbus Dispatch, earthquakes shook southern Ohio today.
Well, there's no fracking going on there. They don't allow it there, so we're all set.
What'd you say?
Exactly, right, no. It's one of those, I guess, moments.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, exactly. I also found it kind of skull-smacking that we're finally giving the last of the code talkers their due diligence in saying who they are and what they've done. I know the movie that was put out, I think, in the early 2000s, Nicolas Cage, doesn't do them any justice. But the fact is, the Wind Talkers, as they were called in this movie, and they're also known as Code Talkers, were handled in some of the same ways that a slave would have been held before the Civil War. And by that I mean that if their handler, which usually was a white American soldier,
naturally,
of a higher rank, usually, you know, like a lieutenant or something, wasn't a person that would, they'd fall around. If they came under fire and that lieutenant thought there's any chance of even getting captured, he would shoot the Native American on sight, because it was better than dead than their language be snuck out to the Germans. And then the American would try to sneak away. But he would kill that Native American because there's a fear that their language would be sucked out by the Germans.
Yeah, no, see... Those languages are incredibly difficult to learn, especially coming from, but yeah, I think you're right, as I recall what I've read about it.
Yeah, in Windhawker, they briefly broached that subject, and in the end, it turns out the guy didn't get killed, but he would have to the war. But there was one point when Nicolas Cage looked at him through a handgun and basically said, "I'm sorry, I have to do this. I don't want to do it, but I'm going to do it." But yeah, so that was pretty daunting to know that. Guess I don't have a terrible lot left to say. I just found all that kind of interesting.
Well, it is. And just going back for a minute to what you were talking about with Yellowstone, I just looked at a projection of the ash fallout. It makes Mount St. Helens look negligible, like nothing.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it not, look like a pimple, basically.
Yeah.
And that will do a great portion of the United States in. Mostly the whole center of the country will be gone, basically. And I'm sure if that thing goes off, that will set off some sort of earthquakes worldwide, too. That's an awful big explosion.
But, not to just run past what you mentioned, but I saw a report of earthquakes in Japan contemporaneous with the attempt to move the fuel rods. And, you just drop one of those, and there goes the neighborhood.
And there's a couple they can't get out because they were bent on the initial insertion back in the 90s. So they're permanently lodged in that...
Now, how does that happen?
This water.
How does that happen? We bent it, and we're just going to leave it there, because what could possibly go wrong?
My understanding is what happened was the device, which is basically a mechanical arm used to do it, was bent in installation itself, so it couldn't put the rods in the right way, so it jammed them in, basically. Because it was bent, it bent them into their position they're in now. So basically, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. If something goes wildly wrong, we're screwed. And I was watching something, I can't remember, it must have probably been on history or something, but it was back when history really did history. And it was a big part about Chernobyl. And basically how they kept it quiet from the Russians and most of the world for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Had no choice. But basically they sent in pilots to hand throw sandbags out of choppers onto the nuclear meltdown. Now, regrettably, most of them died soon after, within hours of doing that, because of radiation poisoning. But that was an interesting piece. And also, I may have mentioned this to you last week. We had it was 2 weeks ago, which makes it even worse in the end. There was an officer involved shooting in my town where they killed a man for waving a shovel at them. Those two officers were put on a paid leave while the investigation was put through. In the end, the investigation shows no wrongdoing because a spade can be a deadly weapon when used the right way. And it turns out the officer that shot him shot this man 4 times.
Jeez.
He went back to work. They both went back to work yesterday.
Well, I've got a story here about a dad in Tennessee. Now, fortunately, and I'm assuming he's white, he didn't get beaten or tased or anything, but there is apparently a school policy somewhere in Tennessee that says that people who walk to the school to pick up their children must wait behind all of the people who are picking up their children via automobile. Huh? Yeah, that's another one. You're going to walk to pick up your kid at elementary school when school lets out. Well, you have to stand there and breathe exhaust fumes until all the privileged hydrocarbon burners are done picking up their precious pumpkins. So a guy who happens to be a sheriff's deputy walked to pick up his kid and got into it with the school safety resource officer, which means cop. And this all took place in Cumberland County, Tennessee.
And the cop said, and the guy was just walking up to pick up his kid and walk home with his kid because it's good for kids to walk. Right? I mean, exercise, so far so good. So he and so their school reading, no, you're going to have to wait back there. You're a walker. And the guy said, this is crazy. And the cop on duty said, I'm going to call some help down here, and we're going to take you up to the jail right now. I'm not putting up with this today. So WATE TV station got out, got on the horn to Sheriff Butch Burgess, Jeremy, and said, and Sheriff Butch Burgess said, well, I don't need to see the video because there's video of this whole thing. I don't need to see the video because it won't tell the whole story. And my resource officer there was just doing his job by making a child wait until all the kids in cars were gone. You know, welcome to America.
Yeah, speaking of won't tell the story, I mean, that kind of harkens back to what happened Friday with Zimmerman, how he called 911 after his girlfriend called because he wanted to set the story straight so everyone knew what really happened.
Right, because the cop, you know, well, I mean, he's got that whole privilege thing going on for him. The cops always listen to Zim.
And, you know, what's even more galling about that story, other than the obvious what happened earlier last year, but I don't know if you saw yesterday, he went up for his bail hearing. The prosecutors asked for $50,000. His lawyers obviously said, oh, no, that won't do. We want $4,500. So the judge said, okay, we'll split it down the middle. We'll give him a $9,000 bail. So his feeling of privilege must just be, I can say one thing, that guy has some good lawyers and people who really want to see him slide on some stuff. Fortunately, this time, he's up for felony assault charges even without the weapon. So he's got problems coming his way, even though he's out on bail.
And the judge has told him to surrender his weapons. And the and I don't know, is that Ohio group of gun goobs gonna raise money for him to have more shooting guns to threaten his pregnant girlfriend with?
Probably, because I think he's saying that he fears for his life, which he should. I'd like to see him go to prison. He'd probably have a fun time there. I'm sure there's lots of people that would like to handle him personally.
Well, without a doubt. Well, Jeremy, you have yourself a good evening.
You too.
All right, we'll talk soon. Later. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. Onward we go. A couple of lines have opened up if you want to jump into the conversation. 304-658-3333. Or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. It's just as easy as can be. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, or Kevin, what's happening?
Oh, not much. I got another story from the Blame the Victim file.
Oh, nice.
Off CNN, a Massachusetts, I guess they were junior high players, but the Massachusetts team canceled the rest of their season's games when this one kid had racial epithets written on his door. So instead of the football team canceling the game with, you know, instead of them canceling the game with possibly the offending team's players, no, they canceled their own team's rest of the season. So this 13-year-old kid gets the blame for having the rest of his team's games canceled, which I just find amazing. It's like, you know, so racial epithets were put on his door, and by the nature of them, you could have probably guessed which school did it. And instead of canceling your game with them and punishing them, you punish your team by canceling the rest of the season. And the only possible grace I'll give them is they said that they had gotten reports of their team also doing that, but those were unconfirmed. And I just, You know, it's another thing to me of, you know, it's like, what's her name, out in Texas, Texas Betsy, saying that's the way they do to punish the kids. They blame the Indians by putting that during the PE class, you know. Instead of making it a positive situation, you end up turning it into a blame the victim thing. And it's amazing to me how that works and how not very many people seem to pick up on the fact that it happens more often than we would like to acknowledge. So, and also, I don't know if you've been following CNN. Do you remember when Brittany Murphy died?
Yes, and I did see that story. Rat poison? Yeah. Really?
Yeah. And the thing that gets you is that this father, you know, when you first heard that he was saying that the L.A. County didn't investigate it enough, you kind of thought, feel sorry for the guy, because, you know, here's a father grieving, and he's looking for an answer, and so he's blaming L.A. County. But as it turns out, he was right. Hired his own private lab, and there was enough lead in there, which is arsenic, which is in the rat poison, to kill two people, and it did. Her husband died about a month later from the same things. In fact, on the coroner's report, the husband and her cause of death was virtually the same. So, you know, and I mention that because it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm being biased, but I think today the police are all over. It's not just in one city, one state. It's all over. There's a sense of elitism among them that if they feel like your case is worthy of attention, they'll give it to you. But if they're dead set that Brittany Murphy died of natural causes, and they got this father saying, no, it wasn't investigated, they totally ignore it. And then, of course, we see the cases where the 14-year-old got tasered. You know, we've had a multitude of cases of different abuses by the police. And I respect the police. I know some good cops. But I'm really getting a kind of a...
Well, how about these cops in Bucks County, Pennsylvania? They had a 14-year-old boy in custody in handcuffs, which I would think is a bit of a problem in the first place, insofar as he's 14. Apparently he was with a 19-year-old cousin or something, and they boosted something from the local Walmart, which, well, in modern America, can be a capital offense with summary execution by the cops. But in this case, apparently they're saying that the cops say that he escaped. He jumped out of the cruiser while it was parked and started running away, and that they tasered him for his own safety. But the photograph, and then he, since he was handcuffed, he was unable to stop himself from falling on his face. But the photograph that's displayed looks pretty much like a righteous beating.
Right, exactly. And that's what I mean.
And I don't have to make mention of the fact that, well, you know.
Yeah, the color of the skin, the pigment. And, you know, you got one going on down now, and I think it's Oklahoma, where the cop is accused, and you have witnesses, some of them police, who are testifying against the cop, saying the cop shot him in cold blood. The guy was no threat to the cop.
I mean, how do you get... I'm looking at the photograph of this young man in Pennsylvania. He's got abrasions and contusions everywhere from the right corner of his mouth, up his right cheek. He's got two black eyes. The right side of his nose is mashed in. He's got scrapes and abrasions across the bridge of his nose and up onto the center of his forehead. And he got all that because he fell down?
Well,
he must have fallen down a lot.
Yeah, I know. And didn't he get tasered?
But then again, remember, we have a member of the Supreme Court who said it would have been okay to just shoot him in the back with a firearm.
Yeah. Well, that's the way these Tea Party people are. If you don't have to be a freaking felon anymore. You just have to be a fleeing less than a misdemeanor anymore to get shot. You know? It's like that girl in Oklahoma that fled, and her and the son got out to help her fight the cop, and then she fled, and there was a whole van full of kids in there. And when you begin to hear of all the abuses that are taking place down there, you kind of begin to get an idea of why that woman possibly ran. You know, I'm not saying she was right to run, but she, look at it from their perspective. And, you know, I think that's where a lot of this goes. There's a lot of fear amongst those of us of African-American descent that they're not going to get a fair shake from the cop. And I know up in New York, there's a video that AATP has online. Same thing. The guy ran from the cops. Why? Because the cops were abusing him. And he ran to protect himself. And, you know, I guess the question I'm asking, is it just me? Or is my perception of cops, not all of them, but in general, my perception of cops is really starting to sour. And is that just me, or is that something that kind of might be the prevailing point of view now among progressives?
No, I think there is real, and it stems from the militarization of the police. And I think it's I mean, how can you say they haven't been? But there, I think there's reason to worry that because I mean, I can remember way back in the 90s when the local police station had a gym in it so that these guys could get all bulked up and be and they'd sit there on the clock lifting weights. And from the behavior of some of them, I think possibly abusing steroids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And with that comes a lot of bad behavior.
And what perpetuates that bad behavior is if the local township doesn't investigate it and do something about it, and further down the state, all the way up to the Department of Justice, how many people were screaming after the Trayvon Martin decision for the DOJ to investigate that? And what's-his-name said that he would investigate it, but we've heard virtually nothing about it. We've heard nothing about the DOJ investigation into that whole affair. And I guarantee you, I believe there was jury tampering, and possibly the prosecution tanked that case on purpose. And I believe it's very possible to prove it. And we've heard nothing from Holder at all about that.
No, I'd say it's probably over.
Well, yeah, except that he was the one that came out and said, we're investigating it. You'd think he'd get back to us on it a little bit, you know. So, anyway.
Nah, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. It's just, no.
Oh, come on.
No. It would just be wrong. I would get, you know, don't say that, Bob, kind of emails.
That's how the right wing does it, create a little bit of controversy where there's none.
And that's why I guess there's articles about the guy who said that Barack Obama would never take under Allah out of the... Oh, my God.
No, it's funny. You know, I read that Bible story last night, and it was just hilarious to me. Because the preacher himself, after thinking about it, said, oh, it was just a mistake. Once he got the explanation, it wasn't him that escalated. It was that idiot from Fox and that guy from WMAL. They were the ones that blew it up. And it was a non-story that got blew up into a story by Fox, which, how unusual is that? So, you know.
Yeah.
It really
you know, I've just been reminded by email that there's something to note here in the whole Zimmerman saga. You shoot a black kid for carrying Skittles and tea and wearing a hoodie, and you walk.
Right.
But if you point a gun at a bleach blonde white woman, you're gone.
Yeah, exactly. Very astute observation by whoever made it. And I haven't heard anybody in the mainstream media, any of the talking heads, make that observation. So, you know, being from Florida, I'm...
Florida?
Not... Yeah, that would be more like it. You know, and I think Zimmerman really was shocked that the judge took away his gun privileges. Poor guy won't know what to do without a gun. And I guarantee if he gets stopped for a traffic ticket or something like that, he's going to have a gun in that car. I promise you, he'll have a gun. You know, when they do those things...
Did he bond yet?
He must have for the judge to tell him no guns.
Since it's a domestic situation, he has to turn him in anyway. That didn't necessarily mean to me that he had bonded.
Yeah. Well, it was a $9,000 bond, which, unless it's, I forget what they call them, where you actually have to come up with all the cash, that's $900 through a bondsman. So, you know, I would think he would have bonded.
Okay.
But then again, wasn't it him and his wife that lied about their...
No, that was just his wife. She took the rap on that.
Oh, that's right, yeah. And poor George is going to take the rap in the divorce with his wife, though. So I guess, you know...
Poor George. Cry me a river.
No.
God. Sometimes it's just hard to get from good morning to good evening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there are days, Kevin, that I look at the computer monitor through the spaces between my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got them here. You want to talk about something disgusting? And there was mention made of how, and I think it was Bill who made the mention about how people protested or said, you know, well, we're paying parochial school tuition. We don't want to pay property taxes. And you remember the story from a week or so ago about the guy, the headmaster from the hoity-toity Delaware private school that got popped for kiddie porn?
Right.
We've got another one, Kevin.
Oh.
And this one's got some star power. In a minute, you're going to go, oh, I see what you did there. There's a guy named Christopher Kloman, and he's a 74-year-old retired Potomac school teacher, a private school near D.C., and he's recently pleaded guilty to sexually assaulting several female students under the age of 14 while he was a teacher. Okay? He estimated that he molested girls less than 10 times from 1966 to 1985. He would do it, having said he wanted to help them with their homework. One victim testified that Kloman pinned her down and assaulted her in the basement of his home while his family was upstairs when she was 14. She was traumatized by it, but did not press charges until a couple of years ago, as a full-grown adult, she found out that Kloman was substitute teaching at her daughter's Maryland grade school. Okay, here's where it gets fun. No, it doesn't get fun. I shouldn't say this. So letters were written to the judge asking for leniency for this creep, this rapist, this child rapist. Okay? Here's the text of one of the letters, Kevin. It might be tennis ball and duct tape time.
Since Mr. Kloman has apparently conducted himself in an acceptable manner for more than 30 years with no other violations, and he has cooperated with the police and accepted responsibility for his actions, we hope the court will provide leniency in his sentence. Mr. Kloman is currently repenting for his past sins and will continue to do so if given a chance to serve his community and neighbors. Community service would be a far better punishment than having him languish in jail.
And what idiot wrote that letter?
That would be Mr. and Mrs. Kenneth Starr.
Oh, my gosh.
President of Baylor University in Waco, Texas.
Oh, my gosh. A former prosecutor doesn't have...
The man who spent $74 million trying to chasing Bill Clinton's cleanest wants a rapist to receive leniency. A guy who raped 14 year old girls over the space of 1966 to 1985.
Yep.
And Kenneth Starr doesn't want him to languish in jail. And you know, he's repenting. Well, you know what, Ken Starr? I tell you what, let's let him out of prison. And let's go and move him into a nice home in the neighborhood where you live in Waco.
Right, well, next door to you in Waco, so he can visit when your grandchildren are over.
And then there's this. I am reluctant to psychoanalyze Chris, but on hearing of his behavior that ceased years ago, and thinking of his contributions as I have known them and outlined them here, it occurred to me that he has seemed as someone who has already been to prison, felt deep remorse, and was atoning. I do not know this for a fact, and indeed it has never been mentioned to me. Rather, this came to mind because his extravagantly energetic community activism has been consistently on a grand scale. Most certainly, were he not in prison, he would continue to be deeply engaged in doing these good works. They seem not just an identity, but apart from his family and, at that very least, his primary interest and his reason for being. That is former Laura Bush aide Margaret Whitehead.
Yeah.
Let's see. Also writing letters in support of this rapist of little girls, Gilbert Grosvenor, former editor and former president of the National Geographic Society. Let's see. Former Assistant Inspector General for Investigations at NASA, William D. Hager. Head of Government Contracts Practice at Aiken Gump, Robert K. Huffman. And then this, Kevin, you're going to love this. When I was hosting Good Morning America, we frequently broadcast stories about forgiveness, and I was amazed that some people who were victimized had reserves of forgiveness far greater than mine. Any punishment for Chris now, however, strikes me as retributive, not rehabilitative. But at the same time, I realize there is a need for accountability. I hope you can find a way for Chris to make amends, stay a part of his truly wonderful family, and contribute something productive and useful to society. That's Charlie Gibson.
Yep.
Quoting Thoreau. So let's recap, shall we? 14-year-old kid runs from the cops at Walmart after boosting a pair of tennis shoes or something equally inane. Gets tasered and gets the shit stomped out of him.
Yep.
Christian white man rapes no less than 9 little girls over the course of 1966 to 1985, including, you know, pinning the child down, using fraudulent means of grooming and enticing, and rapes them, and it would be retributive to put that miserable piece of in prison.
Hey, man, you forgot one word besides Christian white man. Rich Christian white man.
Well, yes, of course.
Because what if the person was someone like us,
by that, I mean income level slightly above poverty. You know, they would throw you under the jail. But because this guy is friends with the rich and not so famous, they're going to do all they can to keep him out of jail. And I can't even understand it under the category of the rich protecting the rich, because we all know with pedophiles, they don't stop. It probably was lots more than 10 in those 20 years, and I certainly don't expect him to have stopped since 1985. I guarantee
you. No, that's the ones they caught.
Right, exactly. And how can you in good conscience let that man out on the community? And to top it off, community service. You want him out in your community?
Yes.
Where he may interact with children?
You noticed that, did you?
Yeah. It's just...
It calls to mind the statement of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the rich are very different from you and me.
There they are, but their children get molested too. What would Ken Starr think if this guy molested one of his kids? Or his grandkids? You know, what would he think? But that's different.
It was $74 million worth of different for a consensual act of oral sex in the... But let's not rehash that, right?
From his perspective, that was $74 million well spent.
I mean, and granted, he wasn't raping little children, but I remember when James Carville wrote a leniency letter for Mr. Scooter.
Yep.
Back when his sentence was being rally the troops, right?
Yeah.
I need to answer a question real quick, because Isaac just asked via Twitter, did the judge buy it? I don't think so.
No.
He was sentenced to 43 years in the big.
Well.
But then again, that can be reconsidered with the right lawyers, and maybe he'll get out scot-free like those folks in, Iowa? Remember a couple of months back? Yeah. Hey, Kevin, it's really good talking to you. Hope we will talk again soon.
All right.
Take care. Later now. Our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. What? Oh, leave it alone, Bob. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. You better leave it alone.
Oh, well.
You've been eating up too much tonight. I can tell you one thing right now. There are three words or three phrases that can basically encapsulate every wrongdoing and every misdoing that you have referenced on tonight's program, okay?
Okay.
There is access. There is money. Access to money. Access to money and power. And that can buy you out of anything in the world in which you find yourself in a bit of a sticky wicket.
It does grease the skids, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely. I mean, it's the petroleum of life, and that's exactly what people go for.
Money will grease the skids sufficiently to render a sandbox into glass.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, we can use all types of sayings, aphorisms, whatever, but nonetheless, that's just the society in which we live. And nothing really surprises me as to which, or as to who gets away with whatever, you know? But I thought Ken Starr, Bob, I don't know about $74 million. I thought he spent a hell of a lot more than that. I thought it was like nearly $140
million. Maybe it was $174 million.
It was a bunch. I mean, it was a bunch just because of that thing. And, oh, God, every time I took a look, Ken Starr, I felt like I needed to take a shower.
With bleach.
No. Not bleach.
Something stronger, Jim?
No. why should I bleach my already white skin even more? Besides, it stinks, and my mountain lion wouldn't like it. He doesn't like bleach, particularly when I put it in the bathroom. He's got some very sensitive olfactory.
I can well understand, and I would hate to hear the complaints.
No, he's pretty good about that. But I will agree with you about everything tonight except one thing, and that's about, you know, the wars in Native America. You know, the Aztecs were pretty aggressive. They were like the Romans of the Central Americas. I mean, they would make war upon other countries or other nations or other tribes, Toltecs, Chichibecs, whomever, in order to acquire, you know, the 100,000 or whatever it was acquired.
Yeah, they were called the Flowery Wars. The goal was not to kill other members of tribes, but to take them captive for sacrificial purposes.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And it really backfired on them, too, because once they got themselves into a sticky wicket and the Spanish came along, the Spanish were able to ally some of these countries that have, or neighbors that had been abused by the Aztecs, and they took an active part in the overthrow of the Aztec establishment.
Yeah, the first peoples that Cortez was able to leverage into marching with him were the Tlaxcalans.
Right.
And it was, and that really was the difference maker. But it wasn't even so much the Flowery Wars, Jim, that led to that dislike. It was the fact that they were an empire, and that they demanded tribute, you know, just as you mentioned, Rome did, and that engendered, and they sent their tax collectors around. And that was what engendered a great deal of dislike? Resentment.
Unfortunately,
the Tlaxcalans only learned when it was way past too late that they themselves had been participating in their own demise.
What do you mean by that? What were they doing?
Well, they swelled. You know, the Cortez's people did not have enough manpower or even firepower.
Oh hell no!
To get the job done. It was only by swelling the ranks with the enemies of the Triple Alliance,
right?
That they were able to, among other things, lay siege to Tenochtitlan. After it was all over, they were subjugated, just like the rest of the peoples were. And one of the first things they did was the Spanish rubbed out. I mean, there's smallpox, and there's the forced religious conversions, the burnings at the stake. But there was also a very deliberate genocide of all of what were referred to as the Papilton classes, the noble class, of all of those peoples. They deliberately genocided the nobles, the nobility structure.
Yeah, the killings did start from the top.
Yeah. They tried really hard to leverage Moctezuma. They tried to leverage Moctezuma. And he was wishy-washy enough that he let him through the gates the first time. And when that didn't work out, well, all hell broke loose. The massacre, for instance, at Chololan, known as Cholula now, in which people were merely dancing at a festival, and the terribly, terribly paranoid Spanish closed the gates and slaughtered everything that moved.
Yep, they were excessive.
There were mountains of fawn skin books and bark paper books. I mean, literally, mountain-sized mounds of them gathered up that were burnt, so that only a few little codices remain, whereby we can know a little bit of detail. And of course, some of the earliest efforts in what we now recognize as ethnography were undertaken by the one or two Spaniards who actually had a conscience.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the only thing
Bernal Diaz and Bernardo de las Casas, I think, comes to mind.
Las Casas, yes. He did report back to the Vatican about the abuses. And, of course, the only thing you're going to see references is what the Spaniards call the La Noche Triste, in which they had gone into Tenochtitlan, and then the Indians had decided they had enough, and they really gave the Spanish an ass-kicking.
They came very close to actually destroying the Spanish presence, and had they not had those, Tlaxcalan and other allies, likely would have. One of the things that contributed to the Spanish difficulties that night, however, was the fact that, well, they realized that they were going to destroy the place, but damn, Jim, there was so much gold. And you had Spanish men-at-arms who were carrying their own body weight and more in gold trying to escape across the causeways.
Oh, yeah.
And somewhere in what was the mud of Lake Texcoco, there is arguably a hoard of gold comparable to the so-called gold of Tolan that was squirreled away by an enterprising and larcenous Roman back in the last century before the current common one.
Oh, God, concerning the amount of gold and how the Aztecs used it and what the Indians really felt about the value of gold, I'm sure the amount would exceed even that. Probably it would exceed what, are supposedly buried in lakes in Switzerland by the Nazis,
Right. And the thing is, those peoples did not use gold as a medium of exchange.
Mm-mm. It was a decorative thing.
It was a religious thing. Gold was literally the blood of the gods fallen to earth.
Well, and that's the reason they decorated their temples and made images and things of that nature. But, it's just the conquest of the Central Americans and the conquest of Mexico. It's,
Well, the 500th anniversary
of
that.
Not a good page written in anyone's history.
The 500th anniversary of that, the beginning of the end, is only a little more than 5 years away.
Yeah, that's true. I would love to get into the secret archives of wherever, in Spain, particularly in Madrid, and even Rome. Just to see exactly, to get a picture of how much gold and whatever happened to it,
Yeah, and then, of course, there was the discovery of the massive silver deposits both in the Sierra Nevada and in South America.
Where was that, Zacatecas or someplace like that?
I think so. But then the really huge vein was found down in, I think, Peru and Bolivia.
I think that's where
the Spanish, with their mercantilist economy, flooded. At first, they thought, we're going to be the richest empire in the world, and they were for a short time. But they flooded the world market with so much silver that even unalloyed, the value of silver simply plummeted because there was so much of it in circulation.
They didn't use it wisely. And, of course, people who obtained things by arcane means often don't use their resources wisely, do they?
No. I think that's trenchant.
Yeah, it is. It's basically deserving upon that, because after that, Spain became without the riches of the Indies and this, that, and the other, and particularly with the rise to power of other nations, particularly England and others, and the merchant adventurers and people like that they basically left Spain with a ruined economy.
Yes.
The Spanish virtually deserted all of their internal means of generating wealth, depending upon that wealth that would come in from the Indies.
One of my favorite films, and I haven't watched it in a while, and I probably should, is The Mission. Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons.
The Mission. Okay, I think I know about it. There was a okay, I know that film. I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, it's worth a rewatch.
Absolutely.
It's set in early colonial what we would know as Brazil.
Oh, by the way, did you ever look up the thing I sent you about Archer 83?
Yes.
Boy, that's a piece of work, isn't it?
You know, on the one hand, you're almost glad you don't know these things are happening when they're happening. On the other,
Abel Archer.
My God, these smart people get themselves into more binds and more fixes, don't they?
I tell you, it's the closest we ever came to 1962. And probably a lot closer, really, because it happened in a very short period of time. And, you know, basically, we could have lost the entire planet over that. We could have, there would have been a war, absolutely, between NATO and Warsaw Pact. And it was all, basically, you know, kind of like war games in that movie of Matthew Broderick. Basically what it was, you know, a computer malfunction. I tell you, you can get these systems so complex and so dependent upon so many things that, well, they can basically do you in. But I encourage everyone within the sound of my voice to look up Abel Archer 83.
It wasn't just a byproduct of bungled military strategy, but it was also a product of the fast and loose, who gives a damn attitude of the Reagan administration.
You know, that continued, and crazily enough, until about 83, 84. And I understand from Kitty Kelly in her biography of Reagan, when that film The Day After came out, and that was viewed before everybody else could see it in the White House, and Mrs. Reagan, and I'm giving credit to her for this, but she had a lot of influence on her husband, you know that.
Yes.
I mean, basically, if you wanted to know who the Vice President of the United States was, Nancy Reagan. And when I think she saw that, and they viewed it together, she said, Ronnie, it's time for us to try to have some sort of understanding with these people, because basically, what good would it do for us to have all this and for the same amount to be used against us? And she was instrumental, she really was, in attempting to change his mind about some of the policies. And there was a decided change and effort towards rapprochement after that film came out. That movie is just, I don't know if you've seen it, I'm sure. The Day After.
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, that's just that's basically a cartoon compared to what really would have happened. And stuff like that. But I think that helped a lot in that particular situation. And I'll have to give Nancy Reagan credit for that. I mean, if Kitty Kelly does, you got to, too, you know?
Yeah. What a fascinating book that was. Hey, Jim, it's time for me to get out of here. We've run plumb up against it.
Oh, my God. Where are you going?
I'm just shutting off the stream so Rick Smith can get started.
Well, I can always send my mountain lion over there to keep you company if you like.
It's a long walk. Jim, have a good night.
You too.
Bye now. And thanks, everybody, for getting us ever so much closer to our fundraising goal. It is much appreciated. Time to get out of here. Thank you very much. Here comes Rick Smith.